June 21st, 1977, and I'm talking with Rear Admiral Finch Noyce, who served with the RCN from 1926 until 1962. Admiral Finch Noyce, would you like to tell us why you joined the Navy and something about your initial training?
I'd be delighted. I joined the Navy in 1926, straight from Appleby School in Oakville, Ontario, because I'd always wanted to, and I was fortunate enough to be one of two Canadians selected for the first batch of special entry cadets to enter the RCN, other than four cadets who had entered in 1924, who had at various stages of their cadetship had been forced to leave the now defunct Royal Canadian Naval College in Esquimalt. In other words, those four officers had been, amongst many others, the victims of the closing down of that naval college, which had been started in 1911 in Halifax. So Admiral Hibbert and myself were the first two Canadians who had never been at a naval college before we went over to England to join up with 60-odd other Commonwealth cadets in what was a well-established method of entry into the Royal Navies of the Commonwealth. This was the opposite number of the normal Royal Navy entry through, at that time, Dartmouth. But in the special entry scheme, you entered at the same age, roughly, as you would have gone to university. In other words, you'd finished your normal high school career and were usually qualified to go to a university if you didn't choose to enter by this scheme. The age restriction on that scheme was you were supposed to be between the ages of 17 and a half and 18 and a half when you joined. And for that reason, when in 1924 they realized that they needed some junior officers, they very rightly invited the cadets who had been thrown out when the Naval College was closed down in 1922, and four of them were still within the age grouping that was required by the Royal Navy, who very kindly had offered their services of this scheme of entry for junior officers to the Canadian government, as we had no method whatsoever of training naval officers at that time. Jimmy Hibbert and I went over at the end of August by the then normal and very pleasant method of crossing the Atlantic in one of the small liners from Montreal. And on our initial trip across the Atlantic, we were joined by a young Canadian who became a very great friend of ours, naturally, and he was also destined to be a naval cadet in our term. But with his brother, already a very famous gunnery officer, his brother had in the Royal Navy, Bill Clouston had been persuaded by his elder brother to join as a naval cadet in the Royal Navy, which he had decided to do. And it is interesting from a historical point of view. Bill was the first Canadian ever who was attending the Royal Military College of Canada in Kingston ever to join the Navy, as far as I am aware. He took advantage of an old offer from the British government, such as was used many, many times by Canadians to join the Royal Engineers and the Royal Artillery. At the end of his second year, he left and joined up with us. Bill spent all the rest of his life in the Royal Navy. We joined early in September 1926, on a hot day, all in our best uniform with 60-odd other mostly English chaps, and spent the next year in HMS Erebus, which was the cadet training ship. She was at a boy in the Hamaways in Devonport Harbor and had just been commissioned after many years laid up in Chatham to take over from HMS Thunder, which up to that point had been used as the training ship for the special entry cadets. While we were in the Erebus, we did our initial training in all phases of naval training at the time, and a great deal of it was naturally basic seamanship, navigation, a good deal of schoolwork, and also as much practical work as we could be taught in that year. We were divided into three terms. So when we joined, we were naturally the junior term, and of our term, approximately 40% were destined to be engineers. The rest of us, with the exception, I think, of about two in our particular term, went on to become executive officers. That is, we went to sea as watchkeepers and normal upper deck officers. The other entry at that time in the Royal Navy, and naturally in the RCN, was the paymaster branch, and that was usually filled by lads who probably had bad eyesight and couldn't go into the other two anyway. But that didn't always pertain, naturally. We were divided into watches and parts of watch, so the term was divided roughly into four people, which was a very manageable size of class, roughly 15. And each term had a lieutenant or a lieutenant commander in charge of you as your term lieutenant. The ship was commanded by a very fine and very senior captain at the time, Captain Paddy Monroe, whose brother was at one time the premier of Newfoundland. He was a wonderful Irishman who we all loved. And the commander was Commander Pelly, who later, from the historian's point of view, is interesting because he was captain of HMS King Alfred when the first terms of acting sub-lieutenants, RCNVR, were sent to England in the early 1940 to be trained in the public baths in Brighton. But he was our old commander, a very keen cricketer. While we were in the ship, she was at a buoy, so all communication was, and quite rightly, by boat. We had harbor craft and we had picket boats and whalers and cutters, which the latter two we learned to sail, and the senior midshipmen learned to run the picket boat, which they would be doing when they went to sea as midshipmen. A very important man in that ship, from our point of view, was the cadet gunner, who was a warrant officer, or actually in this case he was a commissioned officer, and he was the man who really was your sort of nurse. If you wanted to find out anything, you went to the gunner, because he knew everything that was going on in the ship. There was a staff of naval schoolmasters, instructor officers they were called, and a staff of petty officers and chief petty officers, chiefly gunner's mates, and a physical training instructor who taught us gun drill and carried out physical training every morning. It was an interesting experience coming straight from a Canadian school, because at 6 o'clock you were called. You slung a hammock. Which was the normal sleeping accommodation for midshipmen in any ship at that time. So you were learning to do that. You would be called by one of the cadet captains at 6 o'clock in the morning. You'd turn out, lash up your hammock, stow it to his or one of the cadet captain's requirements, and then very wisely you would supposed to have a ship's biscuit and good RN thick cocoa. Some people didn't like cocoa, but I learned myself during my year in the Erebus why they insisted upon you having something in your tummy before you went up to either a very strenuous PT or gun drill or going away pulling in a boat. I missed it one day and I fainted at the end of the PT, so I never did that again. Then we went to breakfast, and again, the Erebus being a monitor, a very famous monitor of World War I, she'd been adopted. She was not designed as a cadet training ship. She was adopted, and as a result of the adoption as a training ship for roughly 120 cadets, we ate and slept and worked in exactly the same gunroom. There were four gunrooms, two for the juniors and two for the seniors, and I think it's the only time pretty well I've ever done all three. So you lived in exactly the same place. Your chests where you kept your clothing and gear were down in the shell rooms and magazines of the Erebus. Being a monitor, she had 15-inch turret, and so there was lots of room because there naturally wasn't any ammunition in those days. Erebus, being in Devonport with a gunnery school up the harbor, they used the turret, which still worked. They used it for 15-inch gun drill for the training classes, and that was always quite an exciting thing to watch the training classes working the turrets, which we didn't do naturally, but we had the run of the ship, and so we got a good look at a 15-inch turret. We did 4-inch gun drill. There were still two 4-inch guns left in her, and we always had something to do, whether we were at work or at play, and the play was just as important at that stage as the work, because we played every kind of game you could play in England at that time, and you at the same time you were learning to sail or run a boat, and there was opportunity to see a great deal of that lovely countryside of both Devon and Cornwall, as we were right on the border. Twice a year we would go away in HMS Carstairs, which was an old World War I coal-driven minesweeper, and that was for pilotage and navigation practical experience, and in our case we went up as far as the north of Wales on our main cruise. And the first cruise in the fall, in November, we ran into several very severe gales, and I can always remember one wild night sailing a whaler for about 6 hours with the term lieutenant and four others, bringing back 50 cadets from the beach in Falmouth, England, and every time in a full moon, blowing about 60 miles an hour, reef down, and about four cadets at a time, so we had a long evening, and that was an experience I'll never forget, particularly as each time we beat back to pick them up, we would pass under the bowsprit of the famous Cutty Sark, probably one of the most famous tea clippers in the world. Hmm. Can you give me a rest now? I can't go on quite so quick.
Admiral Finch.
Yes, sir.
Admiral Finch Noyes. What were the standards required to enter Dartmouth Naval Academy?
Oh, I couldn't give you in detail of Dartmouth Naval College because that was at age 14. And uh-huh. I was never in that field, but I think you might have meant the special entry. And that was an admiralty set examinations based exactly on the entrance requirements for Cambridge or Oxford at that time. And that is what I had to write and Jimmy Hibbert had to write in order to qualify to go. That was the standard they required. And it was in 1926, it was a great deal stiffer than my senior matric exams to go to University of Toronto or RMC. And I'll just stop it for a second.
Well, Admiral Finch Noyes, what about the social aspects of your cadet training? For example, games and preparation for attending mess dinners.
Well, we were very lucky while I was a cadet. In those days, as you were required to be physically fit, they made sure that you played games, both team and at the appropriate seasons, individual ones. So we were taught, if we hadn't played, and such as myself and Jimmy Hibbert, we never played field hockey, we learned to play field hockey. We learned to play rugger, we learned to play soccer, because I'd played very little, and Jimmy Hibbert hadn't played at all. We could play golf on the weekends when we were free, and after Saturday afternoon, if we weren't playing for a team, you could go ashore to Devonport and do your shopping and see some of the countryside. Walking was naturally in that lovely countryside was very much part of our makeup. We went for long walks. We did cross-country running. And sailing races, or just sailing for fun on the weekends mostly, because we were busy in the 5 days up, or 6 days really, up till noon on Saturday. But there was always time for games. In the spring term, our last term, I played cricket. Other people played tennis, or golf, or sailed. The swimming was just about as cold as it is in Victoria, so we swam, but it was a bit of a shock to me coming from Lake Ontario. They took the opportunity, as not everybody had been brought up in a naval atmosphere, to teach us how to conduct ourselves at a mess dinner, and that was done by doing it ourselves. And on every Wednesday night, we would get into our mess kit and carry out the formal routine of a naval mess dinner, which was, of course, made it much easier when we went to sea, and we're expected to know it anyway. In the Erebus, we were very lucky because our captain's charming wife decided that the boys might like a glass of beer, all being good husky people. And so she provided that for a whole year. And that was a much appreciated extra, but I can assure you that cadets did not have the privilege of drinking at any time other than that one bottle of beer on Wednesday night. Another thing that has faded practically, well, it's faded from our normal life, so I guess I'd like to mention it. Everybody boxed during the time we were there. They didn't, if they weren't, didn't, hadn't taken up boxing as a hobby they liked or a sport. But at one time, when we first joined, they just took us by weights and we all had to box an opposite number. And from the point of view of team games, which of course are great training, we played while we were there. We played games against local clubs, some of the neighboring big public schools, and our great rival, naturally, was Dartmouth, which was only about 60 miles down the coast at Dartmouth. And, they were really about a year younger than we were in age, the first teams, but I always remember we had one privilege that we used to exercise, and that was that we were allowed to smoke. And no matter what, I didn't smoke, and a great many of us didn't, but when we went to Dartmouth to play them, and being about a year older than our opposite numbers of the Dartmouth, senior Dartmouth cadets, we were always got a pipe or something and smoked while we were there, much to their chagrin. There's nothing even the captain of Dartmouth could do, because he knew perfectly well that special entry cadets were allowed to smoke, but it was fun anyway. In mentioning the subjects we took while we were cadets, of course I did, and I should not have. We were doing practical engineering during the time, including stoking the Carstairs coal boilers while we were at sea in her, and that was a good lesson and gave us a great appreciation of how tough the job of the stoker in those days was, because when you had to coal fire the boilers of the ship that you were serving in. At the end of July 1927, our time in the Arab was finished, and we were sent on leave prior for a month of August, the normal holiday of people in England at school or university. And in September 27, Hibbert and I joined HMS Emperor of India. The Emperor of India was one of the four Iron Duke class battleships of approximately 28,000 tons, 21 knot speed. And of course, the most famous of the class was HMS Iron Duke, which was Admiral Lord Jellicoe's flagship at Jutland. At this time, HMS Emperor of India was one of the four Iron Duke class, which formed the third battle squadron and was the boys' training squadron for the Royal Navy. The squadron had just come back from the Mediterranean fleet, where they were the crack. The squadron, each ship carried a complement of approximately 1,100 men, of which 600, between 500 and 600 were boys straight out of the various boys' training establishments in the Royal Navy. In our case, we were based in Devonport, England, and our boy seamen came from HMS Indomitable, which was two old men of war, that wooden deckers, which were moored up at the head of Devonport Harbor. We joined a gunroom of approximately 30 officers. Of which the senior member was a sub-lieutenant and ran the gunroom. There were senior midshipmen, about eight of them when we joined, and then the rest of us were junior midshipmen or cadets. But the cadets were Dartmouth cadets who did 6 months at sea as cadets before they became midshipmen. But as far as we were concerned, Our opposite numbers when we joined were 5 Dartmouth cadets. So we were a little body in the middle of 10 junior midshipmen. As soon as we joined, we were allocated to divisions, was the split up of the ship into sections, both physically and from the point of view of the men themselves. And I was allocated as one of the divisional midshipmen to the quarterdeck division. In those ships, they were normally divided into 4 sections: forecastle, main, foretop, main top, and quarterdeck. And as divisional midshipmen, we were responsible for assisting the divisional officer, usually a lieutenant or lieutenant commander, looking after the welfare of the boys who were under training. The other 500 in the ship were naturally the people who kept the ship going. The interesting thing in this squadron, we were not separated from the main fleet in those days. And we were expected, even though we had slightly more than half our complement, were raw boys straight from a training ship. We were still very much part of the Atlantic fleet and were expected to carry out the same duties as the fully manned ones. And such as the Hood and the Battle Squadron and the Nelson and Rodney and the 2nd Battle Squadron. So that, from the point of view of our training as midshipmen, we were very lucky that we didn't lose any of that phase, important phase of our training. I think I should explain that in those days when a midshipman went to sea, he was an officer, and although under training, he carried out the duties of an officer in every respect in the ship and was very much part of the complement of the ship. He was not just one of a batch of people who were allocated to the ship for training. And this, of course, made the ideal training. It also was very important because the men themselves knew that midshipmen were also under training. They also knew that they were officers and exercised the responsibilities of officers. But you could go to a petty officer or a chief petty officer, anybody in the ship, and ask them a question, and they were only too delighted to tell you, whereas when you were a fully qualified lieutenant, you could still ask the same chief or petty officer, you'd probably get the same nice reply, but you were then by that time as expected to know a good deal more yourself. So we probably had it both ways. In a training ship, we probably ran more boats at anchor than the other fully commissioned ships, because that was part of the training. So as soon as we anchored or went to a buoy, we would have every boat in the ship practically in the water from dawn until at least dusk, away both on ship's business or away for training the boy seamen that we were getting ready to send to fully commissioned ships as trained ordinary seamen. This process went on all the time, and I remember the day after we joined the ship in Devonport, the first thing we were told was that the next day we would coal ship. The Iron Duke class were coal burning ships until right at the end of their life, and we took in nearly 3,000 tons of coal, which was quite an introduction to our life as midshipmen. Coaling ship was a competitive job to get the coal into the ship as quickly as you could. You Naturally, the ship, the commander and the engineer commander would organize the ship's company into working parties, both in the colliers, the coal-carrying ships that came alongside you with the coal, or when you were in a port like Devonport, things called temporary lighters, which again brought the coal alongside, and you had to get it from one of the lighters or the collier up on the upper deck and then down into the stokeholes where the coal was stored. And it was a job that in which everybody participated. Most of us physically, but there were exceptions, and quite naturally. The sick bay was manned completely in case any accidents occurred, and unfortunately they did at times, because it was a pretty rough job. The Royal Marine Band, who were not allowed to coal in order to protect their hands for their job, but they played good music for all of us the whole day, so they didn't get off. And in fact, the only person I think that was not actively engaged in coaling, and quite rightly, was the captain, but he was around quite often too, but he quite often used to go ashore and play golf that day, because you'd only get dirty otherwise. But some of the rigs, there was no particular uniform on that day, but I can always remember being told by one of the senior midshipmen to put butter on in our eyelids and eyebrows and ears, so that when we went to wash up after coaling had finished, you didn't have quite so much difficulty in getting rid of the coal dust. And my particular job that I had all the time I was a midshipman was in charge of one of the holds. Colliers usually had three or four holds full of coal, great mountain coal, right up to the hatches. And you had about 20 boy seamen, a couple of ABs, leading seamen, petty officer, and yourself. And then you had bags, each of which carried 200 pounds of coal when filled, lots of shovels, and whips of rope, which you, when there were 10 bags filled, you would whip them up, and off they'd be hoisted out of the hold onto the upper deck, and then from there marines and seamen would take the coal down to the chutes, which went down into the hold of the battleship itself. It was flat out job as long as it lasted, and with these big coalings of 2,000 to 3,000 tons that we took in. We didn't do it as often as they did during World War I when they coaled every time they came into harbor. But we took in more at one time. And it took quite a toll on youngsters who said, you know, the boys were about 16 to 17, and after a while they began to fade. But we never seemed to lose any speed in filling the bags and getting them out of the hold, because something happened to the few able seamen, because they just took over from the kids until they got the rest. And so we kept up a very high standard. You were in competition against your own people in each hold, and this was marked every hour on the signal halyard so the rest of the ship could see it. Also, the amount of coal taken in each hour. So if you were coaling as a squadron, this meant a competition between all four or all three ships that happened to be doing it at the same time. But that was just one experience, and that's how we got our fuel in those days on these ships. Boat running was just part of midshipman's life. When you got a bit more senior, you were given command of a picket boat, which was a 50-foot steam-driven boat with boiler and engine, single screw, and that was the dispatch boat and the boat that took the mailmen ashore and took officers ashore and men as well. We were a sailing ship. We had, in that we had 50-foot launch, sailing launch, and a 40-foot pinnace, and three four cutters, and a whaler, and they were away mostly for training, but if 2 tons of spuds had to be brought off from the shore, say in Portland Harbor, the launch went in, sailed in, picked up 2 tons of spuds and brought them back in. And this was under sail practically all the time. Our commander had the feeling that, and quite rightly, that sailing is a very good way of learning about the sea in a hurry and how to handle boats. But the picket boats, as far, the men mostly went ashore in drifters. Well, drifters were the fishing boat of the east coast of England, but during World War I, in the rough waters, particularly up in Scapa, where the gales were continuous, they found that picket boats was pretty rough work running picket boats in that kind of weather, and they each ship was allocated a drifter, about a 100-foot fishing boat, steam-driven, and these were known as drifters attached to HM ships. They were magnificent training for young lieutenants, and a lieutenant in the ship was allocated as in command. And where the real training came in is they went as a little squadron by themselves from port to port while the big ships went off and did their training. But they were ideal for taking large parties of liberty men ashore, and also for bringing heavy stores and large quantities of stores. They were a big fishing boat, and very fine sea boats as well.